Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello, Kent Beck.
Hello, Dan North.
What an absolute pleasure. Hi, I'm Daniel Terhorst-North. I've been in technology for about 30 years, and the latter 20 of that have been massively influenced by the gentleman I have the pleasure of speaking with today. This is Kent Beck. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Kent Beck. I've been in technology for 50 years, and I've had the pleasure of working around Dan, but we've never actually worked together, have we?
We haven't. We haven't worked on the same gig. That would be very fun.
For us.
I think. Not necessarily for the client, but let's just see. Okay, so where do I start? There's so many different places I want to go. I'm just going to pick one. So as I said, I've been doing this for about 30 years. 20 years ago, I was working with a good buddy of mine, and he had come across this thing called extreme programming that he'd heard of. And it was a book. And he read this book. And this book, one of the things I like about the original extreme programming book is it reads like a case study, right? Mm-hmm. It's not go and do these things. It's not hypothetical, if I were you, I would do these things. It's a load of really practical, applicable things that said, we did this and it worked out really well for us. Mm-hmm. You could try them too. And we went, they sound really good. We're going to try it. And it turned out that we tried them and they worked out really well for us. It has one critique I've heard leveled at it, or one criticism, is the team where these ideas and these techniques came out of was made up of a dozen of probably some of the best programmers in the world at that point, or certainly in the industry at that point, like very talented people. They could have kind of done anything and it would have been fine.
Okay.
Why those things?
Well, so my snarky answer, I'm just going to...
Go snark.
We can snark. I mean, by the time the project was mature, they were awesome. But you should have seen them when I got them. now the fact is, they were experienced programmers to begin with. But the level of collaboration that they developed and the skills that they developed through that collaboration was really amazing. They took basic ideas and ran with them and implemented them in really interesting ways. But the thing about extreme programming is a year on an XP team is better than graduate school. You learn so much about design, about testing, about integration, about tooling, about interacting with clients.
What about feedback? I mean, for me, the whole thing comes back to, like, you get to, it's almost an addiction, right?
Sure.
That you want to know the product's working. You want to know it's solving the problem it's supposed to solve.
You want to get these. You feel terrible if you don't.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And I'd seen too many teams who felt terrible if they got feedback and wanted to create an environment in which it felt bad if you hadn't gotten feedback.
Well, and often because when you do get feedback, it's distant in space and time, sure. A, from when the thing happened, and certainly from when you could have done anything about knowing that feedback.
Yeah,
so it just comes across as a beating rather than a kind of opportunity to course correct.
Right, and you've caused the damage and you don't learn.
Mm-hmm.
So let's shorten the feedback loops. Now, it turns out that shortening feedback loops have social consequences. If somebody comes to you and says, we want all of this functionality by this date, and you say, oh, no, that's not possible. Organizations aren't set up to deal with that answer.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't change the answer. And so it requires careful cultivation of the relationships in the your development, your whole development team, in order to be able to handle that feedback. You have to, first you have to have the technique to create the feedback, but then you have to have the relationships to actually deal with it.
Right, and for me, that manifests in two ways. One is your traditional kind of gated project life cycle, if you like, was each of these meetings is only designed to hear yes, right? We're at the end of the analysis phase, does the analysis pass muster? Well, if the answer is no, we haven't got any more time to do analysis, so it's going to have to be a yes. So we all just lie and go with yes.
Yes.
Same with the design phase, same with the coding. Each of these phases, there's no kind of give in the process to hear no. And so then you get a culture of like, I call it kind of the Stepford Wives type of thing, where just everyone goes around nodding like this, and you're like, there's something wrong here, right? Something weird is happening. And then the other part of it, like you say, someone comes along and says, I want all of these things by this date. And like the message behind the message is, because I've been conditioned to know that there's never going to be a second go.
Right.
If I don't get it all on this train, it's the only train leaving. And the, as you say, the relationships, I've heard this, when you start working in much smaller chunks, you know, you start delivering every quarter and every month. And it's not just that you're delivering more frequently, it's that the things you're delivering are younger. Right, the stuff that's coming out this month,
yes, that's
went in the hopper 4 weeks ago.
Right. It must have been the priority.
Yeah,
4 weeks ago. But then the second part of that is you get used to those deliveries. So if it doesn't come this month, it's fine.
There's another train. I now believe that there will be more trains.
Right.
And the anxiety goes away. And this, you know, people talk about command and control. It's not command, it's regular human beings that are concerned, right? Because they've got reason to be concerned. And if you can take away that anxiety by, look, if you forget it this month, you drop it in the next hopper and it'll come out the next month, they're like, I can sleep at night.
Right.
I like working with this team.
Right.
And they're not trying to ram everything into the one train that's leaving.
Yeah, which doesn't work any more than putting all the cars on the freeway at the same time works.
Right, exactly. Yeah, which I learned that there's a name for that law, and I've forgotten it already. Holly came up with a brilliant name for the idea that if you overload a... if you make a motorway, if you make a highway wider, the idea is if you make a highway wider, then, you know, great, all the cars will move. No, if you make a highway wider, more cars come on, it stays just as jammed. And there's a name for that principle, I can't remember what it was. Okay, something that has... And this is, I suspect this is one of these hiding in plain sight things for you. But when I experienced it, because when you were at the second edition of the XP book, I grinned. I grinned like an idiot, right? And the reason I grinned like an idiot is this. And this is how I describe it as well. In the first XP book, folks, there are 12 sort of practices, techniques, things that you should probably do that we think kind of play well together. Right? They integrate nicely. These things...
Yeah, I would explain it differently, but yes.
Okay, there's a bunch of things that we've figured out that we do, they work well together, they support each other,
yes,
and so on. They actually go in little groups as well. There's a lovely diagram about which things go well together. And underpinning all of this, it doesn't matter what the things are that you do, those are just the things we happen to do.
Right.
Underpinning all of this is communication, simplicity, courage, feedback, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Though that's actually XP. The rest of it is just some implementation detail, right? XP is actually these four things, right? And I know you're going to tell me I'm wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
However, let me get to the question.
Okay.
And then you can unpack how I got that so badly wrong. My observation is this. You then wrote a second edition of the book.
Yeah.
On top of communication, simplicity, feedback, courage, you added respect.
Yes.
Right? And I think you probably had the same, disbelief thing that I had, which was like, why would you have to actually make that an explicit thing, right? It's like saying communication, simplicity, feedback, courage, and don't kick puppies, right? We're going to have to put don't kick puppies in because people have started kicking puppies and we don't know why. And people had picked up the XP Bible and they were just using it as a blunt instrument to tell other people that you're not pairing and you're not doing TDD and you're not doing that. Oh, I didn't realize it was like, yeah.
Yeah, or telling the client, oh, I can't, I'm not going to make any promises.
Right, because you don't do that.
XP is my excuse not to make promises.
Yeah.
Now,
so
how do you have you gotten to the question yet?
Yeah, the question is this, the respect appearing in the second edition, what kind of... led you to, oh my goodness, I need to make this thing explicit?
I grew up a little bit.
Was it really like an experience that you had had since the first book?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. A personal experience. Yes, also, I think there were a group of people who were attracted to that first edition because programmers were the heroes and everybody else were the idiots and us and them, and if only they'd let us be in charge. And that was a reflection of my attitude at the time. And I had a pretty big life reset right around then and had to take a hard, ugly look at myself and find the things. I had to find a way forward that I could live with. And respect for people who are respectful was a big part of that reset for me. And so the second edition was written from a perspective where I'd had to look at some of the stuff I'd said and some of the stuff I'd done and gone, I'm not treating other people like people consistently. I want to do that, both as a moral imperative and as a practical matter in my own life.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come. I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
That's, yeah, and again, because I mean, obviously there's going to be folks watching this that have read one of the books, both of the books. If you read both of them, and I got to experience them in real time. I read the first one in the late 90s, and the second one is they're two different books. It's not for me. It's not like a second edition. Like, oh, you know, yeah. We've added a couple of chapters here and done this. The first book is a bunch of practices around software development, and the second book is how human beings should treat each other in a software delivery world. Yes. It felt like there was a different tone to it, like a different focus.
I paid for that. Yeah. Right.
So that I'm living in the past here, right? This is all 20 odd years ago.
That's fine.
Right? So that's your first album.
No, your first album was second album.
But yeah, but it was a very, very successful album, right?
Yes.
You've done a ton of stuff since then.
Yes.
So let's see, we've got our your three exes.
Yes.
I'm really interested in the genesis of that. And also, I'm really interested in where you've taken that.
Okay.
So for me, there's an arc in terms of, I think, how you see, and you're kind of just alluding to it there, not just how software gets developed, but the ecology in which software is a necessary thing and how it comes into organizations and that kind of piece.
Yeah, so this was a missing piece in extreme programming, is a missing piece of context, which is that the risks to a software project change dramatically over time, and how you respond to those risks necessarily changes as well. XP was naively, I mean, you can only do what you can do, naively just assumed, well, this is like how you develop software.
And it had a kind of steady state vibe to it, didn't it? It's like, we just keep on doing these things, and we just keep on doing these things. And
yeah, yeah. And so 3X came out of my experience of watching projects at Facebook, early Facebook, and how they were treated very differently, depending on whether, at first, the first risk you have is just nobody cares. And so people at Facebook would try out lots of different features, and most of them flopped. And every once in a while, one was the like button or photos tagging that was just massively, massively successful. And what I noticed is Facebook treated projects very differently when it was just speculation and when it had the rocket engine had lit and the thing was just going up crazy.
And so just to give some context to this to our viewers is Facebook at the time, I don't know what it's like now, had this culture of we know that we don't know what's going to be successful. Correct. So we're going to make it inexpensive in terms of not just like money, but in terms of social capital, risk or whatever, to try a bunch of stuff.
Correct.
Because otherwise people wouldn't. And you try all the things. And the reason you tried it, because you thought it might work. But no one tried stuff they knew wouldn't work. So everyone tried the thing that they thought would work. And then every one in N, where N is probably quite a big number, one would be enormous and more than paid for all the others.
Right.
But it wasn't like a loss of social capital or a loss of status to be on one of the ones that wasn't successful. It was just we tried the experiment and move on.
Right. And that is a characteristic of that. I call that the exploration phase, where mm-hmm. where you don't know where that... You're looking for a reinforcing loop where the more you grow, the easier it is to grow more. And you can't guess at where one of those is going to be. And so you just, you, 1/N investment, you try a little bit of all the things. But the risk that you're trying to counter is nobody's ever going to care about this. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, that you overcome that risk. As soon as you overcome that risk and people are actually engaging with the feature that you've implemented, they're going to start yelling at you because they hate it. And that is the best thing that can happen to your feature. Number one, because now it means you've overcome the first risk. Now people care. If you have a mature product and people yell at you about it, that's bad. But if you have, if you've tried this experiment, this exploration, and now people are yelling at you, oh, that's success. But now you have to listen. But people say, you idiot, if only you had this in this feature, then this would be useful to me. And right now it's just crap. Yeah. Like, okay, good. I know what to do next.
Yeah, yeah. You got to take the signal without taking the... Yeah.
Right, fire, without taking on the emotion of it.
Yeah.
You're going to over... It's kind of like the 7 labors of Hercules. You know, when Hercules fails any of the labors, no princess. There's the next barrier to growth and the next barrier to growth. But the way you manage that is completely different than the way you manage exploration. I call that expansion. Mm-hmm. So the way you manage exploration is loosey-goosey, try a little bit of everything. If somebody makes a joke and everybody goes, oh, yeah, if we could just delete the button, everything would be fine. Delete the button, see what happens. Because you got nothing to lose.
Right.
Once the rocket's been lit, now you have... You still haven't achieved anything. You're going up, but you're not up in orbit yet. So you manage that completely differently. Instead of being all loosey-goosey and everybody try everything, you're like, let's throw away as much as we can so we can focus on the one thing that matters next. In expansion, it's a different style of engineering. It's a different style of management. It's a different, oftentimes new team members come in because we're breaking the infrastructure in some kind of way, and we need some really high-class expertise to get over this. It's a different kind of financing. Everything changes when you go into expansion. And the thing is, organizations will get addicted to exploration because it feels good. It's kind of loosey-goosey. And then they'll have one of these successes, and they'll just keep being loosey-goosey. The next risk that hits you kills you.
Because you weren't, yeah.
You're
done. Resilience, yeah.
But what early Facebook was really good at was shifting gears to say, okay, something is taking off, so now we're going to go into the second mode. And that's we're all going to camp out in a conference room and be right on top of each other because that's what lowers the risks. And that's the risk to growth. We can't make this thing grow. So first, the risk is nobody cares. Second risk is we can't make it grow. You can only live that way for so long. You can't stay that way. Again, organizations get addicted to that kind of expansion mode. And they think, oh, that's how development is. But eventually, you have to get to a more predictable style. At the beginning of expansion, you don't know what's going to cause growth. You don't know where the levers are. Mm-hmm. You don't know how they're attached. But eventually you're like, oh, if the fourth country we launch in, we know how to launch in new countries. And then you write a playbook. And that's its own style. That extraction phase is its own style of engineering, management, sometimes even the technology stack. Oh, now we convert it to C++ so we can reduce the costs. And the recruitment, team size, OKRs suddenly make sense. In the early days in exploration, you don't know what metrics matter. You mm-hmm. don't know what numbers would be good or bad. I was talking to somebody who said, yeah, we're forced to predict our revenue of our experimental ads products, and we either achieve $0 or 100 times what we predicted.
Of course.
Those are the two options.
Well, if we knew what we were doing, that wouldn't be called research.
Correct. Correct. So, again, organizations get addicted to that. Extract looks like adult behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You can make predictions. You pull this lever. That dial goes up. You know, people can estimate. You got big teams. You got hierarchical structures. That feels like adult development. And so people try to cram all of their development into that extract style. So you get organizations who are exploration and they stay exploration. They usually just kind of die out because you never take advantage of the opportunities you mm-hmm. create. You get organizations who get addicted to the adrenaline rush and the cortisol of expansion. And then you get organizations that are addicted to that incremental extractive kind of style. And what Facebook was at that time was really good at doing is managing different projects in completely different styles and noticing the transitions between the phases.
So what you won't know is I'm not a finisher. I've got lots and lots of things in flight. I'm 12 years into a book at the moment with 40 odd patterns in it, one of which is essentially about the maturity of a software product, and I call it explore, stabilize, optimize. And it turns out it's remarkably similar. What I like is, I didn't want to interrupt you at all. I wanted to hear your story. Your story is a risk story. It's how you manage yes. risk at different stages. So the way I describe it, and exactly the same, obviously we've observed similar things, for me it's about what you're optimizing for at each stage. So explore, I'm optimized, I want to maximize discovery. The thing in explore, I want more surprises. If I do something and I don't get a surprise, that's a fail.
Right.
Right? It means I did something I've done before. Right? I want to do things.
And you're guaranteed that that's not going to be it.
Right. Right. So I want to maximize discovery. Now I've got the thing, the rocket's launching. Now what I want is I want to make it be the same every time. I want to minimize variance at this point. At this point, I yes. want to focus on keeping it stable,
yes.
right? And stability is repeatability. What I don't want is that I deploy it this time and it's fine. I deploy it the next time and it breaks,
right?
Right? Because guess what? All right, that's when I don't want surprises.
And as you scale, new sources of instability appear.
Right, exactly.
And so the stabilization isn't, let me take this known thing and then make it stable.
And make it cookie cutter.
Stabilization is, okay, now I go into third gear, and now the steering's squirrelier, so I got to get it settled down. But now I go into fourth gear, and now the steering's squirrelier again.
Exactly. And stabilize may not be make the thing repeatable. Stabilize may be a bunch of continual small corrections to keep it on track. And then the third part, which is... optimize is now I'm minimizing cost. So this is my efficiency piece, right? I've got this mass market. I've got this thing that's clearly a revenue generator. What I want to do now is reduce all the inefficiencies, is look at the economics of it. So there's like maximize discovery surprises, minimize variance, economics, minimize cost.
Yep.
And when you published your three axis thing, I was like, this tracks so well with explore, stabilize, optimize. But again, from a different perspective. So I tell sort of both stories.
Well, this is also
because they land differently.
Simon Wardley's Explorers,
Pioneers, yeah.
town planners.
Yes, yeah. He's changed the language slightly, but yeah.
It's the same dynamic. It's a little bit the same dynamic as Kinefin.
But it's, exactly. It's like, you know, when do you bring the grown-ups in?
Right. But, so exploration done right, where you're maximizing discovery, is adult behavior.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
In
exactly.
that context yeah. where you're looking yeah. for something new.
Yeah.
If you do a extract style project in exploration, you're doing it wrong.
Nothing
you're a
happens.
Bad engineer. Yeah. You're a bad business person. You should feel bad.
Right.
You should just be like, all right, we need to try stuff safely. As many different things, and the more different they are, the better. So I say you're optimizing for latency,
mm-hmm.
the time between idea and feedback,
yep, yep.
variance, and throughput.
Okay. Yeah, I buy that.
But software development is going to look similar in some ways. Something like continuous delivery is useful in exploration to reduce latency. Continuous delivery in expansion is useful for repeatability to reduce variance. Continuous delivery in extraction is useful for reducing the risk of catastrophic mistake. Because when you get to extract, you got a lot to lose if you make a mistake. So you're going to see some of the same behaviors out of your engineering team, but they serve different purposes depending on where you are on the curve.
Fantastic. Okay, so you're half a century into this.
Yeah.
I feel like you're just getting started, right? So a couple of things. One is, and this is from a personal perspective. So I've been around, and I described this. I was lucky enough to interview Ward Cunningham a few years ago, and I had a similar conversation with him, which is that you were a producer of this manifesto for Agile software delivery, and I was a very early consumer of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting to kind of look at this document, this artifact, from these two perspectives of like, we wanted to come up with something that we could share with the world, and I'm like, hey, I'm the world, you shared it with me, and it was great. I look at something like, and I'm going to name names, right? It's cool.
Sure.
Let's start with Scrum. But they're all most of the methods that came into the room, you could say. Let's start with Scrum. Scrum says, have these time boxes, and initially they were 6 weeks, and then they became 4 weeks, and now sort of typically 2 or 3 weeks. We're going to have these time blocks. We're going to have these various ceremonies and stuff that we do. And I'm looking at this, and I play it forward a couple of decades, right? And mostly the wheels fall off.
Yep.
So mostly, if you look at the time frame, or the cycle time frame that it was designed in, it makes perfect sense. If it took me months to get a server, having a planning horizon of a few weeks made sense, right? If it took me weeks and weeks to build a feature, planning each day made sense, right? When I'm now in a world where I can spin up 1,000 servers in a morning and they're not even my servers, right? And, and it's a credit card. And, and I can deploy a feature through a browser, and every time you hit refresh, you just get a new app. Then suddenly, these timeframes are so compressed that like if you're planning in as enormous timeframes as a week, I'm eating your lunch. Right, and so I look at a lot of these things that came out of that time, and they're very much artifacts of an age. You can see the context they were in, you can see the problem they solved. I look at the XP practices, the technical XP practices, pair programming, test-driven development, continuous integration, right, working in small chunks, right, all of this stuff, and I'm like, I still use that every day. If I'm writing new code, I generally start with, I call it a code example, but I generally start with a test.
Mm-hmm.
Because it helps me, it's a model client, and the model client helps me design my API and design my code. I guess it's a bit of a closed question, but like, are you surprised that these things that you are articulating, you and Ward and the gang were articulating decades ago, that they're still so relevant and so timely and so just applicable? Decades later, would you have expected the field to have moved on enough that stuff was now?
I'm sad that it hasn't.
Right.
And I'm not surprised. I'm pushing past of this replacement for test-driven development called TCR. Have you tried TCR?
So tell me about TCR.
Okay, TCR. It wasn't my invention. I was at a client and. And I said, I have this thing where at the command line prompt, I run the tests, and if they pass, then I make a commit. So test.shell and get commit. And the student said, well, if you commit on test passing, then you have to revert if the tests fail, just by symmetry. Just I thought, this is going to suck. Let's try it. You know, you should try the bad ideas, right?
Because yeah.
Everybody will try the good ideas.
Well, and what's the cost of trying the bad ideas?
Yeah, exactly. So test and commit or revert. Get reset --hard. So practically what happens is you make some change to the code. You save it, and you should auto-run this thing. But you save it, and if the test failed, the change you made just goes poof. And then you're like, oh, that was right. What's wrong with it? You type it in again, and you save it again, and poof, it's gone. You're like, apparently that was a big change. I didn't know it was a big change. I thought it was four lines of code. Which two lines can I type in first? But that's exact. I mean, the code didn't do what you thought it should do.
That's pretty hectic. I like this. Yeah.
And it forces you to work in even tinier chunks. TCR is just the setup, though. The payoff comes when we're programming separately. What if your machine's sitting there and it's loading the latest version just constantly, and my machine's sitting there loading the latest version from a repo that we share, and we're working in this TCR style? Now, I make a little change to it. It passes, commits. It pushes, it pulls right away to you.
So that's like extreme trunk-based development.
Yes, exactly. But you've got this, because you're working with a much faster feedback loop, you have a level of safety that you can't live without. And now the question is, well, how many people could possibly work this way? And the answer is nobody knows, number one. And number two, I can't even get anybody to try this. It's 5 minutes to set up, and nobody wants to try it.
Well, it's the fear of, and again, I think that this comes back to this idea that code is an asset, that the code that you write is something valuable. And code is cost. Code is a liability. The thing it does is the asset, right? Code itself is. So if I've just tried to make an investment of code, I tried to spend some code and it didn't work, I just got my money back.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. I get to try a different investment, you know, but it's you have to kind of flip that mental model of like, no, I just did this work and you just deleted all my, you just wasted my time.
Right.
Or I just wasted my time. Why would I do a thing where I waste my time?
Yeah, but you just did something that didn't work.
Yeah. Which means it was a surprise because you learned a thing and the point was to learn.
It was already a waste of time.
It was already wrong. Yeah, it was already wrong, yeah.
Yeah, it was already wrong. So why not just delete it and you get back to that state where, I know how everything. So the collaborative version of this is called limbo, because the question is how small can you make the changes? You know, how low can you go?
Very nice. Okay. And, no, I had not come across this.
Yeah. Let's see, and I started on that rant because you asked.
I was asking about practices and how they, and you were saying, well, you're kind of moving beyond that now.
Why hasn't it gone further, or am I surprised? Yeah, I am surprised it hasn't gone further. I wish that people were inventing stuff that I think is crazy and couldn't possibly work. Instead, I feel this tug back. Oh, don't make me write tests. There's this TDD backlash. Mm. You can't make me write tests. I'm a great programmer. You don't understand how good I am.
That's why I stopped calling them tests, Kent. There's a reason I stopped calling them tests. It's because you end up in a load of arguments that are nothing to do with the practice. The practice is writing model client to guide what you're trying to do. It happens that you can use it as a test after the fact, which is nice. But you're not writing a test. You're writing a specification that you're going to...
Maybe you should just get over that.
Yeah.
just saying.
I know. You're not the first person who said this.
Here's the fundamental question is, are you responsible for the behavior of the code that you write?
Right.
If you're responsible for the behavior of the code that you write, then I expect to be able to come in and see how you're taking that responsibility.
And to show me examples.
Show me working.
Where are the
receipts?
Yeah.
And if you say, well, I'm too good for receipts, I think, no.
You don't get to spend my money.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So I just wanted to throw in here because it feels really timely. So Amy Edmondson, who's one of my absolute heroes, Professor Amy Edmondson, coined psychological safety, which itself is a brilliant. I love failure stories. So she was doing this PhD in she was studying surgical teams. So in the US, you'll know this. I didn't know this. Surgical teams go around as like a pack. We have a surgeon, and that surgeon will have their anaesthetists and their nurses and their whatever, their crew, and they go around, and that surgeon's surgical team goes around and does stuff. So it's an interesting thing. If you want to do team studies, it's a really interesting thing to study. So her PhD thesis was, we believe that high-performing teams make fewer errors. Seems like a pretty true, right? I'm going to go study high-performing teams and demonstrate they make fewer errors and get a PhD. So she goes off with her research buddy, starts measuring teams, and she found exactly the opposite. The surgical teams with the measurably higher success rates had more, like statistically significantly more errors. And she's like, brilliant, I just blew my PhD. What do I do now? And then she had this insight. And the insight was this. What if they have exactly the same amount of errors as anyone else, but they report them? So now it was, okay, so now these teams feel like they can report these errors. Right. And once they're out in the clear, they can learn from the errors and iterate and blah, blah, blah. And suddenly I've now figured out why these teams are successful. Right. And so then her research was, what is it about these teams that makes it okay for people to talk about errors? And that's where psychological safety came from. And it languished as a kind of an academic backwater thing for nearly two decades. Meanwhile, and you'll know about this, Google was doing this Project Aristotle. They invested hundreds of people for years trying to figure out, like, we've got 60,000 engineers, what makes a great team? We must have the data to what makes a great team. 200 data points, right? 200 whatever parameters went in. None of these parameters, no combination of these parameters, was at all a signifier of successful teams. They're about to give up. Someone came across psychological safety, plugged that into the model, bang. It was a bigger signifier of successful teams than all the other parameters put together. I'm like, wow. So like her failing a PhD and then them failing at Aristotle was what kind of brought it to attention. But so that's her first album. Second album, she's just done a thing. She's like, okay, well, where does that go then? Where that goes in terms of, and interestingly, so that's stable teams, right? She's talking about. Now, what happens when you're starting a new thing? And it's exactly your three X's. And she's now just published a book about a year ago, I think, called The Right Kind of Wrong.
Okay.
And The Right Kind of Wrong is about failing well, right? And it ties in so well with what you're describing, is that, you know, if you're doing this kind of limbo style development, what you're doing is you're plotting a path along exactly the right kind of wrong. How close can I skate to the edge of the right kind of wrong, right? I got it wrong, but I know how I got it wrong. And as I learn more about how I got it wrong, I start getting it righter. And it just feels like a really nice, I can't articulate it, but it feels like where you're going with limbo and where Professor Amy is going with Right Kind of Wrong just feels like there's a convergence there.
So my the yes, you're absolutely right that it's the degree of safety that we're shooting for. I imagine a kid picking up a iPad with Limbo on it, and they're connected with the Limbo server that everybody's using that's completely live. And they go and they drill into it and they see some code and they make a change to the code and they press save. And, or even, I mean, we'll start with this scenario. And if it sticks, it sticks. They've just made a change to software that's being used by a billion people. As a kid who doesn't really know what they're doing, but it's fine because it's perfectly safe. Now, you also have to make it perfectly safe for bad actors and scammers and blah, 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 all that stuff. But what would it take to have that level of safety in this system? This is super trunk-based development. And then you think, oh, well, that's not practical. And I say, fine, we call that a research agenda. And we figure out how to create that sense of safety. How do you lower the latency and improve the results of that kind of filtering so that if you make changes that are going to cause damage, they don't make it through the mesh. If you make a change, doesn't cause any damage, might be better. Sure, it goes through and it's immediately sent out to everybody else. That's the vision that I have. And I came up with this at Facebook. We had 5,000 engineers, and a lot of people were thinking about how do you have 10,000 engineers, but nobody was thinking about how do you have 100,000 engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, this is just a dumb trick. I'm going to extrapolate 10 times as far as everybody else does. I did. And that's what I came up with.
And what's interesting to me is you've got... So Ward takes his wiki, his original wiki idea, and he says, well, how do I federate the wiki? The wiki's really cool, but it's a single instance wiki. How do I get a federated wiki? And you're like, I've got this sort of TDD into kind of manic TDD into limbo. How do I get like federated limbo? I feel like there's just kind of like this federated energy going on, which is kind of cool.
Well, the question is, how do I make a contribution that other people can leverage?
Fantastic. Yeah. That's a lovely, lovely hanging question to finish on.
Super.
Kent, absolute pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.